This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with LSU Mass Communications Professor Bob Mann, soon to be inducted in the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame and a writer of renown, now writing columns for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. We'll talk with Bob Mann about what's happening at Louisiana State University. There has been a truce of sorts involving the furor over the names of those who applied to be president of the university being released to the public at large. We'll talk about what happened yesterday in the court of Judge Janice Clark. Also, the Deke fraternity in hot water over an inappropriate sign that was displayed before the Kent State game. And LSU ranked 12th among 14 SEC schools in academia by U.S. News and World Report. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. We're joined by LSU Mass Communications Professor Bob Mann, former Communications Director for Kathleen Blanco, the previous governor of Louisiana. Also worked quite closely with U.S. Senators John Breaux, Russell Long, even a bit with Bennett Johnston. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
How many years now at LSU?
7 years.
7 years. And you have been lancing the current administration, and some are concerned about your well-being, Bob. Are you okay?
Yeah, some people are concerned, but I tell them not to worry. I do have tenure, for one thing, and it's awful hard to fire somebody who has tenure. I believe if I didn't have tenure, I'd be gone. I would have been gone a long time ago. I would have met the same fate as Fred Cerise and John Lombardi and Mike Martin and others who've lost their jobs out there because they ran afoul of the Jindal administration in one way or the other.
Well, we had your friend Jim Nickel, and longtime colleague, on this show a few weeks ago, and Jim said that's just politics. That you take care of your friends and you punish your enemies.
Well, it is, of course, it is politics, absolutely. And Fred Cerise, I think, will tell you. He's told me that he doesn't begrudge what happened to him in the sense that he was very much against their policy, and they had the right to replace him and find someone who agreed with their policy of privatizing health care in the state. What I think concerns a lot of people is that there is a board of supervisors that is supposed to be making decisions on behalf of the students and the faculty and the staff and the citizens of the state, supposed to be representing the best interests of the university and the state, and making decisions based on not what the governor tells them to do, but what is best for the university, best for the state. And the question I think a lot of us have out there is, why do we need a board of supervisors? Why don't we just make it another cabinet office and let the governor run LSU? Because as currently constituted, the LSU board of supervisors are a bunch of lapdogs and yes men for this governor.
Well, there are 16 members, and 15 of them are men. So I guess in Bob's estimation, 15 of them are yes men, and there's one yes woman.
There's one yes woman. And, the other thing about that I think a lot of people have concerns about this board and the way the governor has – everybody on this board is someone the governor has appointed or reappointed, except for the student member, who is the LSU – who happens this year to be the LSU student body president. But every one of those people that the governor has appointed, except for Ann DePlessis, mm-hmm. former state senator – is a white male. That board is not only doing the governor's bidding, letting the governor tell them what to do, but they don't represent the state. They're all white men except for one. And that's wrong. It's also unconstitutional. The constitutional says that the constitution of this state says that the LSU board should represent the diversity of the state. And it clearly does not.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Robert Bob Mann is our guest. Yesterday, there was a development regarding the 125 days that the board had gone without coughing up the names of those who applied to be president, along with King Alexander, who was chosen by the board. Judge Dennis Clark apparently will receive those names, and at some point will determine whether or not they should go before the public. Presumably she will decide to do so at some point while the court proceedings continue. What do you make of this?
I guess it's a partial victory. At least the board is now recognizing that that Judge Clark has some authority over this matter. They were in contempt of her for a couple of months now and weren't recognizing the authority of the court. So they've at least acknowledged that she has authority, that she clearly does. I think that it's not a completely satisfactory outcome or compromise from the standpoint of those of us who want to know who was in that pool of applicants or candidates for the job of president of LSU. The records are still under seal. Now Judge Clark is sitting on them, and I think people hope that this will be resolved quickly, and we'll be able to see who wanted the job and who King Alexander was competing against. But it's it amazes me, Jim, why LSU persists in drawing this out. I think the end result, regardless of whether the university prevails in court or not, is that the reputation of the university has suffered because of this. I mean, Board of Supervisors being held in contempt of court, being threatened with jail, images on the news of sheriff's deputies showing up at the LSU system office to retrieve records, which they don't have because they've circumvented the law by basically outsourcing their public records responsibility to a private company in Dallas, makes us look silly and stupid and foolish. And I think it tarnishes the reputation of LSU. And the members of that board who work for Jindal and who were appointed by Governor Jindal have really destroyed, I think, the reputation of this university in a lot of ways that should be shameful to them. And you know, I hope at the very least when these fines are paid that they come out of the pockets of these LSU board members and not out of state money.
Well, I would doubt that would happen. And what was it, 124 days, so $62,000 in fines, unless Judge Clark decides to waive the fine.
Well, let's hope she does, because I think you're right. I think that these board supervisors themselves will not cough up the money, even though they should, and even though most of them can well afford it. They won't do it. If the fine is paid, it'll come out of student fees or tuition, which really compounds the crime.
Well, LSU, as I noted at the start, is ranked 12th among SEC schools for academia by U.S. News and World Report. The best SEC school is Vanderbilt at number 17. The least is Ole Miss at 150. LSU's at 135 among national universities, according to U.S. News and World Report. And obviously this is an imperfect judgment, but a lot of people put stock in it, and LSU's ranking has gone down. Now, the football team, 6th in the nation, the university is 12th in the SEC. There's a bit of a disparity.
Yeah, well, if our football team were ranked 132nd in the country, there'd be a riot.
135.
I'm sorry, 135. You're right. 135. And if we were
there, would ranked, be a riot.
There would be a riot, and the football coach would be fired. The athletic director would be fired. Probably the board of supervisors would be forced to resign for allowing the football team to degrade so much. But, you know, academically, we're rated fairly low, and you don't really hear much of much concern.
Well, it's a good point you make, because it is quite possible that the majority of people in Louisiana would rather see the football team ranked 6th and the university ranked 135 than the university as a whole being ranked 6th and the football team being 135.
Absolutely. No question. I think there's no question about it. It's obvious that that's the case.
And LSU is behind schools like Arkansas, Alabama. Alabama's 86th in the nation. Georgia, Auburn, those schools are at South Carolina. Those are in poor southern states too.
Yeah, you know, I read recently that Alabama has something like half of its students now are out of state. They're coming into Alabama. You and I have a good mutual friend,
Jim Nickel.
Yeah, who has two of his daughters going to Alabama. And I don't think it's because they thought that LSU was a substandard school at all. Those are two young women who went to the lab school and I think wanted another experience. And I wouldn't begrudge anyone's children for going out of state and getting another education or a better education. But the fact of the matter is that Alabama is attracting people that LSU is not.
297-5633 for Bob Mann. Alabama ranked 86th nationally among schools in academia by U.S. News and World Report. LSU 135th. LSU in the news nationally as well for this fiasco regarding the Deke House. The Deke fraternity, one of the long-standing fraternities next to the Catholic Student Center at LSU. The alma mater of Mike Foster, the former governor, Steve Myers, the founder of Tiger Rag, and many other luminaries in the community. And
is that Steve's?
It is. Okay. Yeah. And Saturday, before the Kent State game, the Deke members posted a sign outside the house setting. Getting massacred is nothing new to Kent State. They pulled down the sign. They put up an apology saying they apologize to Kent State for the inappropriate sign. Is this enough?
Well, one part of the story you didn't mention that was in the Advocate this morning. I haven't read this morning's Reveille because I haven't been to campus yet, but that the campus police came and told them to take down the sign, and that President Alexander is debating whether there should be some official sanctions by the university for this. I think it was stupid and really, really, really poor taste, and I wish they hadn't done it. But this is the United States of America. Now, I know this First Amendment has in some ways been suspended on the LSU campus, but I think these we have the right to be stupid. We have the right to say really ugly, nasty, awful things. We don't have the right to do it in ways that endanger people, like shouting fire in a crowded theater. But we have the right to be stupid, but we also have the obligation to suffer the consequences when we do. But those consequences shouldn't be government sanctions, like police ordering us to stifle our speech or university presidents telling us that here's what you can and cannot say.
Well, the ACLU has weighed in on the side of the Deke House. But remember, a few years ago, LSU stopped those purple and gold Confederate flags from being flown on campus, too.
Right.
A stupid thing to do, but when you get right down to it, if somebody wants to make a jerk of themselves and risk danger to themselves, do they have the right to do it?
Yeah, I think clearly they do. And that's the age-old debate in this country is the limits of free speech. And I might be offended by what you say, but I think most of us would agree we would fight to the death for your right to do that. And it's not often comfortable to live in a country where anyone can say any stupid thing. But that's what makes America unique.
Jim on Highland. Jim, good morning. You're on with Bob Mann.
Bob, I would like to ask you, with the new administration, it seems like they're willing to talk to the faculty more, and it's my understanding in the past that y'all have had no communication with the Board of Supervisors. Is that true?
Well, I can't speak about the contact from the Board of Supervisors. I don't hear from them at all, so I don't know. I don't see them on the campus. I don't see them at my school, for example, although we did have a very, I think, productive meeting just last week with President King Alexander and Stuart Bell, the provost, who came to my school, the Manship School, and I was in a meeting with them, and he's very interested in the work we do, and I know that he's having those visits around campus. So I think there is some cautious optimism on campus that we have a president who does care and more importantly is a little more competent at dealing with people than John Lombardi was. I mean, you know, Lombardi had his strengths and weaknesses, but one of his weaknesses was interpersonal relationships.
297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757 outside the area. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Celebrated writer and professor Bob Mann is with us to talk about what's happening at LSU and beyond. We are even going to discuss David Bruce Vitter, the junior senator, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for LSU Mass Communications Professor Bob Mann. Mike on Sherwood. Mike, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
I just wanted to make a comment on the Kent State signage. Had a buddy in town for the football game from Kent State this weekend, past weekend, and we drove by that sign. And earlier in the day, we had seen on the internet the ranking of LSU on in the national rankings academically, the 135. And we just shook our heads, and he commented that the sign just kind of makes the 135 shine. And that's about all we had to say.
Well, I think if going by Deke's example, we're not even the top 200 when it comes to good judgment in class. But I think that our school is better than that, and I think that's the thing that I'd like for us to remember is that, you know, it's often in the news the worst behavior is what gets covered, but the everyday kindnesses and generosity of the faculty and especially the students doesn't get covered because it doesn't make news because it's not newsworthy because it happens a lot. But it's a good campus with good students who care deeply about their fellow man and woman.
297-5633. Phil and Jefferson Terrace, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you so much, Mr. Mann. I mean, just for being a calm, speaker and a logical person about what, you know, the situation we're in.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. I have to say that, I mean, over the years, there's so much hatred that's been being cranked out on talk radio. There's just the disrespect for the president and the office, and I just consider it to be big lies, you know, that are told by the media, corporate-owned radio. And you have to just see what the right wing does. They're basically all about big business. They support Alec. They spend millions on little peanut races.
All right. Well, Phil, you're getting off on a tangent, but the lack of civility is certainly out there. And, you know, Ann Coulter recently on one of these national shows called the president an ape.
Yeah.
A monkey.
Yeah. It's not good, and honestly, it's not great on either side. I don't want to pretend that the left doesn't behave in dreadful ways as well. But we need more civility. We need to be respectful of one another. That's for sure.
Well, speaking of civility, David Vitter has asked that members of Congress follow the tenets that are spelled out under Obamacare. It's not an unreasonable request, but he's blocking other things that are pressing in Congress with his attempt to do this. Some call that grandstanding. Do you think that's grandstanding?
Yeah, well, I think it is, mainly because he's trying to put this amendment to an energy bill that doesn't have anything to do with health care, and he's tying up the Senate by insisting on a vote on a completely unrelated amendment. It's also a silly grandstanding amendment that wouldn't hurt most senators, but would really hurt a lot of hardworking staff members who don't make a lot of money, and maybe one of the better, maybe one of the more valuable pieces of compensation they get is a decent health care plan, which, by the way, is very competitive, sort of like a health care exchange that Obamacare is creating in all the 50 states. I was in that system for almost 20 years, and if these healthcare exchanges work like the federal healthcare exchange does, I think people are going to be very happy with it.
Well, according to Politico, Democratic leaders have drawn up a bill in response to Senator Vitter that would deny government finance coverage to lawmakers if there's probable cause to believe they solicited prostitutes.
Yeah, you know, that's an attempt to embarrass Vitter and to bring up the prostitution scandal. I think all that is just so beneath the dignity of the Senate. I mean, you know, my first reaction, I guess, was to chuckle a little bit at it, that, you know, Vitter hoist on his own petard in a way. But honestly, are there not better ways to settle these disputes than to engage in kindergarten, schoolyard antics like that? I mean, I just think it's beneath the dignity of the Senate. When I first got to Washington in 1985 working for Russell Long, our delegation worked pretty well together, the Republicans and Democrats. There weren't a lot of Republicans, but there were a few. And my boss, Russell Long, counted among his best friends Bob Dole and John Danforth and a lot of other Republican senators who he found ways to work with. He didn't always agree with them, but he worked really, really hard at building the personal relationships that paid off for Louisiana in many ways. My boss, John Breaux, did that for three terms in the U.S. Senate, and it paid off for Louisiana in many, many ways. The Senate is almost unique among governmental institutions where those personal relationships count for a lot. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't moments when incivility and hardball tactics aren't called for, but if your colleagues fundamentally don't like you, and most of Vitter's colleagues don't like him on the Republican and Democratic side, and I would say he's got as many enemies among Republicans as he does Democrats, you're not going to get much done for your state. And if your objective is to go to Washington and ably represent your state, he's not doing that very well.
297-5633 is your number. HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on with Bob Mann.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Mann, one quick question here. I think it was Senator Vitter, but don't quote me on that, publicly stated in the paper that if Obamacare goes through, like it's supposed to on October the 1st, I think it is, that members of Congress should also be made to take the same Obamacare as the general public that we're talking about. What is your opinion, please, sir? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's what this whole debate is, that Vitter's amendment is to say that all members of Congress and their staffs, for some reason they exempted the staffs of the various committees, but that all members of Congress and their staffs would be required to drop their federal coverage and go into these health care exchanges. The rub is that there was originally some language that Senator Grassley proposed. This is all because of something Grassley proposed, Republican senator from Iowa, that said that they would go into that healthcare exchange, but that the federal government would continue to contribute its share of the premium. Somehow that got dropped out at some point, and the Obama administration went in and made an administrative ruling saying, well, the government will continue to match the premium subsidy, like most companies do, and the federal government does. And Vitter is insisting that members of Congress and their staffs be pulled out of the federal system and be thrown into the health care exchange for the District of Columbia or Virginia or Maryland or wherever they happen to live, and they would have no federal subsidy at all. And I think a lot of people think that's not fair, because they're not getting treated like most government employees, and they're not getting treated like most corporate employees whose employers do provide some subsidy of their health care premiums.
297-5633, still time to talk with Bob Mann. Nicholas on Nicholson, sending an email to inkstershow@wrkf.org, says the fraternity students who wrote and hung the sign presumably are our leaders of tomorrow. I see tomorrow as a gloomy future for us. Do kids grow out of this?
Look, they did something really stupid. And you know what? I think they're learning from it. Hopefully they're learning from it. Although this, I have to say, Deke has a history of hanging stupid signs up, apparently, according to the Advocate this morning. But yeah, I think hopefully they learn from it. I certainly learned from a lot of the dumb stuff that I did in college. I'm not proud of everything that I did, but I did learn from it, and I think they will too.
Wait till Johnny Football comes to LSU and Texas A&M.
Oh my God, yeah.
I imagine the decals will have some choice words for him displayed outside the Deke House. Now, they've done things like this before, as have other fraternities, but the Deeks seem to take delight in being as outrageous as anybody, and they're getting attention. Maybe this isn't the kind of attention they want, but they did apologize, too.
Yeah, they did, and they hung up, I think, a very appropriate sign of apology, and so they did the right thing. But I get, again, go back to my concern that the campus police and the president of the university shouldn't be telling them what they can and cannot say. If they want to be stupid, they have the right to be stupid as long as they're not endangering people's lives.
John in Lafayette. John, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Short comment and maybe a question. The Deke House, I was speaking to someone this morning who's 85 years old. When he was at LSU, he was a member of another fraternity, but he said the Deeks were known for this sort of antics even back then. So this is not something new. This is something that they have been doing for many years and have a reputation for doing, and some of the kids joined the fraternity for that reason. Mr. Mann, I'm hopeful that you remain at LSU and continue to speak out on public issues, especially having to do with our governor and his lack of support for higher education. I think you have you demand a presence, and people will listen to you, whereas a person like myself, no one will listen to. So I'm encouraging you to continue to speak.
Well, thank you very much, and I plan to as long as I can. I can do so, and I'm privileged to have the forum that I do now in the Picayune to do that, and I continue to hope I can use it to speak out on behalf of LSU, although I don't want to become just a spokesperson for LSU, because it's higher education across the state that's suffering, not just LSU.
Now, Ryan on Whitehaven says it's a bigger story that the LSU Greek system is still segregated in 2013 than what the Deke House did, and that's a story. Generally, in fact, maybe exclusively, they're all white fraternities, all white sororities, and a few black fraternities and sororities.
Yeah, and you know, there's a big story that some of your listeners may have noticed. And out of Alabama, there was a sorority that got in the news just last week for that same thing. And yeah, it is a very segregated society on campus in a lot of ways. But it's probably not much more segregated than our churches are in this community.
Our neighborhoods.
Neighborhoods.
Private clubs.
It's segregation is still a part of our lives. Some of it voluntary, most of it voluntary, but in the case of perhaps some college fraternities and sororities throughout the South and perhaps elsewhere, it's not voluntary. There are young people who want to join these organizations who are prevented from doing so because of their race or their religion.
But these are places that are on state property.
Yeah.
And they're discriminating in 2013.
Well, presumably they all have charters that prohibit this. I wonder who could enforce these charters.
Well, that's a larger question, I think, and a good one from Ryan, is that here we are in 2013 and we're worried about a foolish sign, but has the Deke fraternity and its long history had one black member, at LSU?
Well, you know, if there were the wonderful thing about diversity is not just that it meets some racial quota, but that it brings in diversity is more than just skin color. It's diversity of opinions. It's diversity of perspective. It's geographical diversity. People who come from being exposed to different people with different opinions and different experiences widens your worldview. And we certainly need that in Louisiana.
Last week we had Kay Goss on this show, who's a lobbyist and has written a book about Wilbur Mills, and she said that she thought he should be, I'm paraphrasing, but be given a pass for voting for the Southern Manifesto, 1956, to ban whites and blacks from hanging out together in public places. Russell Long voted for the Southern Manifesto.
He signed it.
Excuse me, it wasn't a vote, it was a signing.
Right.
Alan Ellender signed it. Hale Boggs signed it. Do they deserve a pass on this?
No, I don't think they deserve a pass on it. And by pass, I'm not sure what you mean.
Should history judge them harshly?
Yeah, I think history should judge them harshly. Now, that doesn't mean that history shouldn't also take into account the fact that these are different times and that what's evident today was not so evident then. But I'm also persuaded by the fact that in 1956, when the Southern Manifesto was signed, there were people like Lyndon Johnson and Albert Gore.
Three senators from the South.
Ralph Yarborough.
It
was Ralph Yarborough, Lyndon Johnson, and Albert Gore, I believe, who were the three.
Kefauver,
so that would make four, who refused to sign it. And I guarantee you there were other senators who signed it under duress, and they knew it was the wrong thing to do, and they were ashamed of it for the rest of their lives. Yeah, I think it's clear that there were people who knew it was wrong. There were people in the 1850s who knew slavery was wrong. Perhaps you can't judge people. You can't apply today's standards and what we know today to yesterday, but it also ignores the fact that people in the 1700s knew slavery was wrong.
All right. Yarborough was not in the Senate at that time. It was Price Daniel of Texas who signed it.
Daniel signed it?
He signed it. So the only three Southern senators not to sign it were Lyndon Johnson, Albert Gore Sr., and Estes Kefauver.
Yeah.
That was a bold move by LBJ.
Well, Johnson was majority leader at the time and was he knew he had to, if he ever wanted to be president, he had to start moderating his position on civil rights, and that was evidence that he was doing that.
But that's not so long ago, Bob. That's 57 years ago.
Yeah.
And there was a law passed that year in Louisiana signed by Earl Long to essentially do the same thing, to ban whites and blacks from going to congregating in public places like Tiger Stadium. We had A.P. Turow, the first black undergraduate student at LSU, on the show a few weeks ago, and that was 1953. And
what a man.
Yeah.
What a man. One of my heroes. One of my heroes.
Charles on North Foster. Charles, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I just heard your guest say that you can't hold people accountable for standards that we have today that they knew were true and yesterday. If that's the case, are we going to face the same judgment when we stand before God and he tells us that it was wrong to enslave our brothers, and we say, well, God, we didn't have those standards in the 1800s or the 1700s. And my next question is...
All right, hold tight. We'll come back to you, Charles.
Well, I don't think that's exactly what I said. What I say is that what we know today and what are generally agreed upon standards of conduct and behavior and interpersonal relationships are different than they were even 10 years ago, but certainly 100 years ago. But so I do think we can hold people accountable to some degree. I just think that that it's unfair to impose those standards completely. We just can't do that. But there were people in the 1850s and 1830s. John Quincy Adams was opposed to slavery and got gagged on the floor of the U.S. House for speaking out. And so, yeah, I think we can hold those people accountable for their unwillingness to recognize the humanity of all people.
But yet, absolutely, we remember Thomas Jefferson as a great president, and he was a slaveholder.
It's complicated, and that's my point. It's complicated, and it's not to. Pardon the pun. It's not always black and white.
Well, Charles, if you hang on, we'll stay with you through the break, and we'll take a few other inquiries if we can with Bob Mann, 297-5633, if you'd like to join us, 877-217-5757, and inkstershow@wrkf.org. We'll return after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Bob Mann with us for a few more moments. Dan, downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, you've discussed about viewing politicians in the context of the past, but what about with the perspective going forward? Say like your boss, John Breaux. He uses his contacts that he made while he's in office and then goes and becomes a lobbyist, looking out for corporate America rather than the public that he had been elected to serve.
Well, you're right in the sense that a lot of former members of Congress are becoming lobbyists, and I think that is a troubling development. At the same time, it's not illegal to be a lobbyist, and he has a right to make a living. I'm not going to condemn him for that. I think you judge the person on how he conducted himself or herself when he or she was in elected office, and did they conduct themselves honorably, and then you judge them on how they conduct themselves when they're out of office and when they do any job, whether it's as me as a teacher or a newspaper columnist or John Breaux as a lobbyist. And if you have evidence that he has broken some law or some ethics rule, I think you should report it.
Chico on College. Chico, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Fine.
Jim, I just wanted to say I think what the Deeks did was extremely stupid and racist. But we have to remember, I mean, I know you said the Deeks have only had one black member.
I don't know that they've had any.
Oh, okay. I thought you said they had one. But there are many other fraternities and sororities at LSU that are black that do not have any white members.
Well, wait a minute, Chico. They formed because they were excluded from the white fraternities. And when I had Perry Franklin on this show a few weeks ago, he says they have had white members.
Some of them have, but it goes both ways. I mean, it's just so silly to talk about. The racism problem is only black on white on black, because if we don't talk about it both ways, it's never going to get fixed, Jim. That's all. And you know I'm not a racist. I just think we need to talk about both sides of the equation, because it goes both ways, with politicians also. Right. That's all I have to say,
okay.
Jim.
Thank you, Chico. Appreciate it. Well, we do need more dialogue.
Yeah,
and the only way to have it is to have people together in the same place at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
David at LSU, you'll be our final caller for Bob Mann. Hi, David.
Hey, Bob, with all this racism going on, could you tell us your group now, or your friends, or any black American group?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
I guess he asked, do you have any black friends?
Do I have any? Oh.
That's reaching the black youth and the mothers from birth through pre-K. That's working.
He
wants to know if any black American group is doing good things as far as improving our society.
No. Education and works. Education. Pre-K,
okay.
Birth.
Okay,
birth.
Education.
I'm not sure I understand the question. I got it in snippets, so I don't really know that I understand what he was asking.
I'm not sure either, but we always enjoy your company, Bob.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Good to see you as always. And we're joined now by Duff McDonald. He is a writer of note, and his book is The Firm, and The Firm is the story of McKinsey and its secret influence on American business. Good morning, Duff.
Good morning.
Well, the McKinsey Company. This is a company that many are unaware of, but it's a big player all over the world, and among its alumni, Governor Bobby Jindal and Economic Development Secretary Stephen Moray in Louisiana. How formidable is McKinsey?
I kind of make the claim in the book that it's one of the most influential private organizations on the planet. They are strategic consultants, and they are basically whispering advice in the ears of power, whether it's corporate or government, in every major country economy in the world, and many more.
Well, you note that it's been around for a while, this particular company. It started when?
In the mid-20s, it's unclear, 1926, 1927, something like that.
Duff McDonald, he lives in New York City. He's written a book about the McKinsey Company, and Harvard Business Review says this comprehensive history of McKinsey offers a sense of how the industry's most elite firm has shaped the ideas that drive business. How formidable is this company?
They, McKinsey advises the majority of the Fortune 500 companies. Obama's hired a bunch of McKinsey people, as you just said. Bobby Jindal is McKinsey. Basically, it is a group of people, typically with an MBA background, but not necessarily, who get called in when executives or boards of directors have problems that they can't seem to solve. What do we do next? How do we respond to this competitive threat? What division should we shut down? What one should we expand? And they get brought in behind the scenes to help them out. So it's both a significant influence, because their ideas you know, are influencing the decisions of the largest companies in the country. But it's also fascinating because it's kind of an unknown influence. They are definitely, they don't take credit for their work. They just come in, help out, and then leave quietly through the back door.
Well, you point out that McKinsey has had a big impact on compensation for CEOs. How did this happen?
That's actually a fascinating story. In the early 50s, a McKinsey consultant did a study that showed that remarkably at the time, worker pay had risen faster than executive pay. And surprise, surprise, a lot of executives suddenly wanted to get their hands on that study and look at it and use it as a rationale to jack their own pay up a little bit. And while boards of directors and companies have to make the ultimate decision to raise a CEO's pay, if you look back at the origins of what they call the CEO pay gap, which now stands at 350-1, the average CEO compensation is 350 times the average worker. It was that study which suddenly became very much in demand. That McKinsey consultant accounted for 10% of the company's billings for a decade. That is, I think it's original sin in the widening of that pay gap that's been widening ever since. So it happened more than 50 years ago, and if you look back, it's like, oh my gosh, that's where it all started.
The book is The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business from Duff McDonald, 877-217-5757 if you'd like to talk with Duff. You note that President Obama has several McKinsey alums in his inner circle. The White House has had this concept as far as hiring people from this firm for decades, right? Going back to Eisenhower.
Yeah, in fact, one of the fascinating things I found in the book is the origins of the industry, and McKinsey in particular, were early 20th century when American business had actually had a run of success and conglomeration that was unprecedented in history. And we had companies like DuPont and General Motors and AT&T suddenly at a size and scale that no one had ever seen before. None of the European countries were large enough that companies could get to that size. And in the U.S., what happened is you had all these giant companies being built, and suddenly the people running them said, oh my gosh, how do we run this thing? Like, how do we control it without letting it sort of spin out of control and you know, devolve into chaos? And so McKinsey's original bread and butter business, which is what's called organizational consulting, sort of doing org charts, you know, the stuff that looks like a family tree. We've all seen them in our company setups. And the White House, when Eisenhower was in there, sort of faced a similar problem. He, you know, his big government had happened post-war. We were in, you know, the government had expanded massively. And suddenly Eisenhower and his team were sitting there thinking, how do we actually run the government more effectively? And so they actually brought McKinsey in to restructure the White House, and one of the things that came out of that was the chief of staff position. That came from McKinsey.
You note in your book, Duff, that McKinsey has had some spectacular failures, too. For example, they were involved with Enron quite closely, weren't they?
They were very closely involved with Enron. Jeff Skilling, the CEO who's in prison now, was a longtime McKinsey consultant, and he brought a lot of McKinsey ideas over to Enron with him. Among them, the sort of an emphasis on vision over current execution. At Enron, those who were rewarded most were those who had the most aggressive forecasts. You know, we're going to do this 10 years from now, and they'd get all the funding and raises and stuff. And also securitization, off-balance sheet financing, really aggressive human resources policies about promoting, you know, strong-minded and strong-willed people and culling the bottom of your ranks. And McKinsey ended up celebrating Enron in his House publication, the McKinsey Quarterly, which is read by a lot of executives around the country, more than it had any other company. And they were pulling down about $10 million a year from Enron. And when it all sort of exploded in a fraudulent mess, the amazing thing is McKinsey sort of walked away from it. It goes back to my point about them being behind-the-scenes advisors. Arthur Andersen is out of business because they were the Enron's accountants. But McKinsey, as advisors, their defense is, we didn't do any of this. We were just providing advice. It's up to the people who actually make the decisions to take responsibility. It's a brilliant business model.
Jackie asks, how active is McKinsey outside the United States?
Very active. They went into Europe post-war, so they are very influential in Europe. But they're a global firm. They're in South America. They're a big presence in Brazil. They are a big presence in China, Japan, Korea. The current managing director of McKinsey, his appointment is kind of a sign of the times. He spent most of his career in Asia. China is clearly the firm's biggest push right now.
297-5633, McKinsey & Company. Now, Bobby Jindal, as we discussed with Duff McDonald, the author of The Firm about McKinsey, Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, he spent, I think, less than a year with this company, and it's his only job that I know of that was in the, quote, private sector. Is that the custom? Usually people come and go, or do they usually stay for a while?
It's interesting. McKinsey, not a lot of people last very long. One in one in six people stays 5 years or more. That's it. But McKinsey is actually viewed, and so a couple of people have done studies, including USA Today, as the premier generator of CEOs. The odds of you becoming a CEO if you work at McKinsey are higher than at any other organization. And it's because they, the issues that they deal with are CEO-level issues. So oftentimes you'll have a board of directors sitting there saying, oh, we need a new CEO. Who should we hire? And then they look across the table and they say, well, why don't we hire this guy from McKinsey who's been helping us with this problem anyway? And it's an MBA crowd, for starters, anyway. So these people are aimed in that direction from the get-go. But their level of access and influence is such that more people than you could possibly believe are running public companies with a McKinsey heritage, and in government as well. They're all over the government in England and in North America in particular.
You point out that McKinsey has set the bar for dress codes. The way people dress in business is quite often influenced by what happens at McKinsey.
Yeah, not so much these days, but the point I made in the book is like that as one of the early management consulting firms to really have an influence in sort of World War II and post-war era, the dress code, a lot of people attribute that to IBM as well, sort of the blue suit IBM guy. But McKinsey had a lot to do with it. Well, they had a lot to do with the language that people use in the corporate space. They had a lot to do with the way people comport themselves in community relations and corporate relations. They sort of set the standards for a lot of white-collar behavior from mid-century on, and it's certainly something that people aren't aware of, that it all sort of derives from more than anywhere else from this one particular firm.
And when layoffs occur, quite often the employer, you say, blames McKinsey for calling for the layoffs. How does this work?
It's another one of the things they offer their customers, which is they wouldn't say this out loud, but as an outside advisor, McKinsey is in some ways available as a convenient scapegoat. And because the bulk of their work is about how to operate more efficiently, more effectively, how to increase your profits, in times when companies think some big layoffs are due, it is not uncommon for them to hire McKinsey.
You got to roll, but thank you so much, Duff McDonald. Good book, The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.